They're very good prices for seniors.
And if you're out in the suburbs, you can go to the Joy Theater in Tigard for $1 on Monday night. unless it's in 3D, then it's $2.
In the next episode, we pay a visit to the Hollywood Senior Center on 40th in Northeast. There's a wealth of activity over there, including a class on how to make musical sounds with a ukulele. Don't miss it. And here's a quote from someone you know. I look forward to growing older when what you look like becomes less and less an issue, and what you are is the point. That's from Susan Sarandon. You've been listening to our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archive contractor for 40 hours a week for $20 an hour. This is a contract position that will last from July through December of 2018. The archive contractor will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms. They will work with historical KBOO content in many audio formats, as well as the Resource Space Archival Database, documents of KBOO history, and KBOO staff and volunteers. Please send in a resume, cover letter, and answer the question, why is KBOO important? To Dell at kboo.org. That's DEL at kboo.org. More information about responsibilities and position requirements can be found at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO-FM, the Pacifica Network, and online at madnessradio.net. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Laura Delano. Laura is an ex-psychiatric patient, and in 2010, she withdrew from five different psychiatric drugs that she was taking for more than 12 years. Laura is the co-founder of the Inner Compass Initiative and its Withdrawal Project, which is an online hub for psychiatric drug tapering and withdrawal and for community building. So welcome to Madness Radio, Laura Delano.
Thanks, Will. It's great to be here.
So, Laura, your work is so important in the world, and I'm really excited about the new Inner Compass Initiative and the Withdrawal Project that you've just recently launched. I really want to encourage people to check this work out, and it's great having you on the show because years ago, you were also a guest on Madness Radio, and it's awesome having you back, and I want to encourage people to check out your other Madness Radio show, which is available on the archives on the internet and through podcasts. And you've been continuing to do this withdrawal work, and you're offering a really important resource to people. Maybe we could just sort of give us a general summary for people who haven't heard the previous show. Tell us, what was your story? How did you get on all these different medications, and how did you end up withdrawing from them?
Well, my story began back in 1997 when I was 13 years old and basically had this profound crisis of self that I won't get into the details of here, but what I ended up beginning to do was act out at home. I had a lot of anger, rage, irritability, great despair. I was cutting myself. I was thinking about death. And eventually my parents just grew terrified because I kept it all together at school, but I'd come home and I would fall apart in these ways. And so understandably, as you know, so many parents are taught to do in our society, they reached the point where they said, my God, we're so worried about Laura. We don't know what to do. We should send her to a professional for help. And
you were 13 years old when this happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was 13 and I was first sent to a family therapist, but eventually she referred me to a psychiatrist because I was too, you know, serious of a case. And that psychiatrist in the first appointment, you know, I'd never met this woman before. She knew nothing about me other than these, you know, brief descriptions of my behaviors at home. And she proceeded to tell me at the end of that session that my anger and irritability were symptoms of this thing called mania, and my despair and self-injury and urge to die were symptoms of depression, and that I had a condition called bipolar disorder and that there was no cure for it. I'd be living with it for the rest of my life. But the good news was that there were medications to help me manage, and with therapy, I could find my way. And there I was at that point, I was 14, and it just ripped me apart inside to be told that essentially I was fundamentally defective. The psychiatrist put me on Depakote, which is classified as a mood stabilizer, and Prozac, which of course is classified as an antidepressant. But I hated the drugs. I hated what they represented, which to me was, you know, the world thinks I'm broken. So I did avoid taking them whenever I could.
And then what happened? At some point you did switch and identify as bipolar and start agreeing with that diagnosis and start taking the meds regularly?
Yeah, that happened when I was 18. And so I ended up finding my way to Harvard, which, you know, I somehow was still holding as this pinnacle. Like if I could just get to a place like Harvard, maybe I'll realize I'm wrong all along. And actually this is what will make me happy and what will make me feel good about myself. And so I got there and right away it became very apparent that nothing felt any different, that I still didn't know who I was. I still wanted to die. I still felt like I didn't fit into the world. And so I really spun out that fall. And a few months in, I just, that voice of that first psychiatrist telling me I was bipolar kept, it just got louder and louder and louder until I realized there must be something wrong with me. She must have been right, because I've done everything I meant to do to succeed and be happy, and I just want to die. And that was the point that I totally embraced this idea of being sick and bipolar. And I started to do lots of therapy and take lots of drugs. And the next 10 years, that was like who I was. They told me that I had so-called treatment-resistant bipolar disorder.
When did that change? When did you start saying, wait a second, maybe I'm not this bipolar sick person that I'm being told I am?
I happened upon a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whittaker, which I know you're well aware of course, Will. And basically, the thesis of this book is that if you look at what the science is telling us about the long-term use of psychiatric drugs, you see that we've actually been told a story about their safety and effectiveness that is far from true. And so suddenly I was faced up against the realization that, like, what if it hasn't been treatment-resistant mental illness all these years that's been making my life fall more and more apart? Like, what if the treatment itself has actually been at the heart of that? And that was my aha moment that really propelled me on this journey out.
And then how did you get off the medications?
I am a good example of how not to taper off in a way that's safe and very careful. I had no idea what I was doing. I don't even know if I knew that withdrawal was a thing. And so, yeah, I came off of 5 psychiatric drugs that I was on at the time. It was lithium, Lamictal, Abilify, Effexor, and Ativan.
Wow, you were really over medicated. All those different drugs are just doing all kinds of different things different directions.
It was so many different drugs doing so many different things. And I came off of them in 5 months, which is incredibly fast, basically cold turkey. But I at the time, all I cared about was getting these drugs out of my system as fast as possible so that I could figure out who I might be off of them. That was kind of the driving, the thing I was going towards. And so I lacked solid information around just how risky and potentially dangerous it is to come off of these powerful drugs so quickly. And I ended up having, I mean, getting off of them was the hardest thing I ever did. And I was in so much physical pain. I had these horrible gastrointestinal issues, chronic headaches, like really strange, like disgusting, huge boils erupting on my neck and my face and my back, and strange smells coming out of like the skin on my chest. Like I just had such agonizing physical pain, and my mental and emotional state was just like this uncontrollable roller coaster. I was like a Jekyll and Hyde. You know, if I lived in a different set of circumstances, if I didn't have the privacy I had, if I was under the watchful eyes of the police or of other surveillance authorities, if I didn't have family by my side to help me, you know, have a shelter and food, I don't know what would have happened. But I was just so lucky. I got basically anything that a person might need to survive psychiatric drug withdrawal, I had.
And if you didn't have that, you might have just been stayed stuck in the system in a kind of revolving door, which is what happens to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And then, so a lot of what we're talking about, you go into more detail in your other Madness Radio interview that I, again, encourage people to check out in the Madness Radio archives. But what are some of the things that you've learned about the whole healing process that maybe you would do differently? Or what are some of the more recent things that you learned looking back on this whole experience of coming off all those meds abruptly?
I'd say at year three off, in between years three and four, I began to really come alive. My cognitive functioning returning, my metabolism figuring itself out. I began to feel increasingly more connected to my body, to my creativity, to my sexuality. My emotions began to like reintegrate. So even though they're still very intense today, I'm not at their mercy in the way that I was. Just at year three, a lot began to change. And it's just been this gift ever since. And a big part of that process has actually been around learning how to listen to my body again and to the messages that it's telling me, especially around what I put in it. So food and, you know, the products I use, like to clean my kitchen, to clean my skin, like all I've become increasingly in touch with what my body feels nurtured by and what it feels harmed by. When I look back on the last 7.5 years of my withdrawal journey, like that's really sat at the heart of what's helped me to heal, I think.
So Laura, it's inspiring to hear that you've connected with yourself in this very, very deep way. It's taken 7 years for you to do, and it's still an ongoing process. But let's start with someone maybe who's taking psychiatric meds now. Let's think about, because I know your work is so much about educating and working with helping people come off medication. Let's talk about some of the things that people need to think about, some of the steps people need to take, and some of the things they need to prepare themselves to get into the process of starting this whole journey.
A couple of years ago, I was given the amazing opportunity through a family foundation who believed in what I was doing to launch a new nonprofit organization along with a small handful of my colleagues that we've called Inner Compass Initiative. And much of our focus has been on getting the Withdrawal Project launched, which is an online comprehensive hub for all things psychiatric drug withdrawal, essentially. And we've just launched actually in January. So we're really in the process of getting ourselves out there as much as possible.
And what is the web address for that?
So the web address for Inner Compass Initiative is www.theinnercompass.org. And the website for the Withdrawal Project is withdrawal.theinnercompass.org.
So how would people get started if they are on psychiatric drugs of some kind and they want to think about coming off?
Recognizing that the journey off psychiatric drugs doesn't start with the actual taper. It starts with preparation, with taking all the time you need to really think through, first and foremost, the beliefs that you're carrying about yourself and about these drugs, and to really spend time thinking about this relationship you have to these pills, and how these pills have come to shape your sense of self and your relationship to your emotional and mental pain or struggle or so-called madness, whatever we want to call it. I think starting there is important, and just coming to it with a kind of curiosity and non-judgment as well. So I think, yeah, part of this early process of preparing to come off, it has been in many ways about facing this fear of myself and like finding a way to let go of that and to reclaim the ability to trust in myself and to listen to myself. And that's actually where our name came from, Inner Compass, is, you know, we get disconnected from this intuitive wisdom that we all have within us as human beings by not just the mental health industry, but our schooling system and our government and all these powerful, you know, institutional and corporate structures around us. They train us to not trust in ourselves and to seek, to consume, to turn our power over to, you know, professionals and services and this and that. And so it is about learning how to listen to yourself again and believe in yourself and trust in yourself.
Another piece is also the support piece, because often it's not just our own beliefs, but the people around us. Was that an important part of your experience, and also one of the things that you're teaching people to look at the support piece of this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what I'd say is that my support system through the whole process was just so instrumental to my making it through. My family and I, they were unwaveringly there for me through it all, but none of us really understood what was happening for a while. So it was scary. It was confusing. I'm imagining that at points along the way, they probably worried, my God, has Laura made the wrong choice here? But they hung in there with me. And eventually, as I began to heal, like, that's, you know, I also began to really educate myself and also help my family educate themselves about not just the drugs, but the diagnoses and the history of the DSM and all of that. And at that point, my support system, I think, became really, really strong.
So you mentioned coping tools, Laura. What are some of the main coping tools that you see people finding?
I mean, there's such a broad range of strategies people have developed, and it really does speak to just the uniqueness of the withdrawal experience. You know, for some people, like, intensely rigorous cardio exercise is literally what helps them survive the akathisia, whereas I have friends who can't even walk up a flight of stairs without setting off a fight or flight response in their body because their GABA system is, like, so injured from benzodiazepines. And so, yeah, I'd say, you know, I think beyond nutrition and removing chemicals and kind of detoxifying one's environment, which is quite a universal practice that I've seen in the withdrawal community, some of the more common things I've seen are, you know, just people finding ways to be with what's happening for them, whether that's breathing or meditation, like walking outside, taking a bath, you know, whatever it might be that allows a person to hang in there with what's happening to them, that general theme, I'd say. And then on the flip side of that, what also is incredibly important for many people, and it certainly was for me, especially in the darkest hours, was having a reliable toolkit of distractions from the present for when things just get too much. And for me, I think I probably said it on our radio interview back in 2012, but like South Park saved my life. Like, it literally did. And I would just watch episode after episode when I couldn't sleep. And of course, you know, one could say, oh, television is bad for sleep hygiene. But honestly, in the worst hours of my insomnia, it was all I could do to get through the night was to distract myself from my mind by watching the show. So yeah, I think whatever that distraction might be for you.
Let's talk about the role of prescribers, because a lot of times people will tell me, well, you know, I want to come off my psychiatric drug, but my doctor won't let me. And I'm thinking, are you on probation or parole? But people have this attitude, and it's, you know, the attitude that so many doctors and general practitioners and psychiatrists have of they're the ones who are responsible, and therefore they're the ones that are going to make the decision because they're taking care of this disease that you have, and it's their job to do it the way that they've been told to do it. And that's a very difficult situation for people to be in. So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, working with prescribers and some of the things that you've learned around that.
Yeah, and it's, I'm so glad you raised this because it really is an essential piece of the puzzle. And and I relate a lot to what you just said. I mean, when I remember for the first couple of months that I was seeing my psychopharmacologist, he I would ask him each time I saw him, you know, I'd like to come off, and he'd say no, and I'd say okay. So I'll step back for a second, because there are different ways you can come at it. Some people, their instincts are telling them, I need to have a collaborative relationship with my prescriber here. I don't want to lie. I don't want to keep secrets. I can't do that. I can't put my head on the pillow at night. And so some people then really focus on thinking strategically about how can I get my prescriber on board with my desire to come off? And often that looks like really getting informed yourself about not just how to taper off in a manner that reduces risk as much as possible, but also just about the drugs themselves and understanding their pharmacology and, you know, and whether or not the drug is in a form that can be safely tapered, or if, you know, asking the prescriber to switch it to another form makes sense. And just the more time people take to put together a plan and to show their prescriber that, you know, listen, like, I've taken this really seriously. I've spent a lot of time educating myself, thinking this through. This for me is all about reducing risk and optimizing my chances of success. Like, can we partner together? You know, for some people that can end up being successful because the prescriber realizes, like, wow, my patient's serious here. They're not just going to do something reckless. Like, they're taking their time. On the other hand, some other people find, like, I just can't, I don't even, there's no chance my prescriber is going to be collaborative. I'm going to, you know, do this secretly and get support elsewhere. And
sometimes you just got to do that. That's the situation that you're in. And I think there has been a message, you know, that only come off your meds with your doctor's approval. But I think that's a dangerous message, because that can mean you could stay on your meds when you need to come off of them, and there aren't enough doctors who are supportive. And sometimes you do have to just take matters into your own hands, because it is your body and it's your life.
Totally. And I think recognizing that, you know, that of course can look to an outside observer like a very serious matter. Oh, you know, so-and-so is secretly stopping their meds. This is cause to lock them up. And so I think recognizing the risks,
the consequences.
Yeah. And to really think through, like, if I'm going to do this, you know, how do I, you know, take all the measures I can to protect myself and my rights. I think that's an important thing.
One of the things I've seen that sometimes helps is if you go in with a plan, also if you go in with a family member and you can show them that there's multiple people that are involved that are supporting you. It's not just, you're not just doing this on your own, but you have go into the appointment with your mom or with your brother, whoever it is, and just have them speak up for you and say, yeah, we've all been working together on this. We support this idea. And then there are some magic words that I often see being helpful. And the magic words are, you know, thank you, doctor, for all the help that you've given me and for the medications, the usefulness that if you can find any usefulness at all in the medications, to acknowledge that. And then to say, you know, if it doesn't go well, I will certainly consider going back on the meds. That seems to reassure their prescribers.
That's a good tip.
What you don't want to do is go in with a copy of Anatomy of an Epidemic or, you know, something Laura Delano's, you know, podcast recommendation. You don't want to come across as being anti-medications. You want to be seen as being pro-health. You want to be seen as doing the right thing, not from an ideological stance or any kind of rigidity or bias, but just from, hey, I need to try something different here because this isn't working.
Yeah. And I think just to add on to that, also putting together a plan for, you know, if things do get tougher, like, what else are you going to do? You know, I'm going to you know, here's my plan. Like, I have these friends who will meet up with me. I'm going to get this kind of exercise. I have this meditation practice. Like,
yeah,
showing your prescriber that you're thinking through, like, all the different ways you can help yourself if you do come up against difficulties. And in addition to, yeah, like, the, you know, quote unquote openness to go back on. I think just the more you can reassure your prescriber that you're being responsible and thoughtful and considerate in this decision-making process, the greater the chances that they'll work with you on it.
Tell us about the TWP Connect aspect of your work, because I think that's a really crucial part of this. It could be really helpful for people.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking about it, because it's the part of what we've built that I'm most excited about. So, yeah, I mean, as you said, there are tons of online spaces at this point where people can support one another to come off of these drugs and share experiences and all of that. But where I think we're still a bit in the dark ages is around in-person local community for withdrawal. And, you know, with so many thousands of us all around the world who are coming off or have already come off or who are thinking about coming off of these drugs, you know, chances are in every town and city, like, there's at least two people who are thinking about this with the many millions of people on these drugs. So the question becomes, how do we find each other? And so we've built this platform called TWP Connect that allows people at all stages of the withdrawal journey, from just thinking about the idea of maybe coming off or reducing one medication, all the way to people who've been off for, you know, 10 plus years. Fill out a little registration form. It can be anonymous. You basically share a bit of information about where you're at in the coming off journey, what kind of needs you have, what your interests are around withdrawal, and then our technology, like, you tell our system where you're located generally, just like the town you're in, and then you can actually search for other members based on geographical location and interest and needs. So you could say, I want to find five people within a 5-mile radius of New York, you know, of Brooklyn, who are 2 years off meds because I'm just starting the process and I want to get some mentorship from someone. So you enter those criteria, and then all the members who meet those criteria show up, and you can contact them via a message system through our website that takes you off site to your email. So we don't actually have forums or chat rooms. Like, we're not trying to replicate a social media platform. We're really creating this online tool to facilitate in-person connection. And so I'm really excited about the possibility of, you know, of people finding each other. And then in the months to come, we plan to share resources for organizing support groups and discussion groups and all of that. And we actually have the same platform over at the Inner Compass Initiative website that we call ICI Connect. And it's the same thing, but basically for anyone who's asking questions or thinking critically about the mental health system, because there are so many of us and power comes in numbers. And when you think about just how profoundly transformative it can be to sit at a local coffee shop and have a cup of tea with someone and just connect through shared experiences. Like, that's the kind of thing. It's the kind of thing that could help someone not check themselves into the hospital that night if they're really struggling, or, you know, a potluck dinner with five people from your town where you just talk about how hard it is to be alive, or you have a fun, like, critical conversation about the DSM and, you know, these simple, free connecting opportunities can be really transformative. And my thinking is, this is how we're going to really change things moving ahead, is at the grassroots.
Laura, we're just about out of time. Give people the contact info and the website address for your work.
Yeah. So if you're interested in learning more about our nonprofit, Inner Compass Initiative, or in learning about, you know, getting a critical look at psychiatric drugs and diagnoses, you can visit us at www.theinnercompass.org. And if you're interested in the withdrawal project and our, you know, step-by-step companion guide to withdrawal and our connecting platform and our coping resources and all of that, you can visit withdrawal.theinnercompass.org. And you can be in touch with us by emailing hello@theinnercompass.org.
Laura Delano, thank you for joining us on Madness Radio.
Thanks so much, Will. It was great to be here and to catch up with you and to chat about these important issues.
You've been listening to an interview with Laura Delano. Laura is an ex-psychiatric patient who withdrew in 2010 from 5 different psychiatric medications after being on them for 12 years. Laura is the co-founder of the Inner Compass Initiative and its Withdrawal Project, which is an online hub for psychiatric drug tapering and withdrawal and community building. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is sponsored by the Icarus Project and Portland Hearing Voices. Host is Will Hall and producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio can be heard on KBOO FM and the Pacifica Network, and shows are archived online at madnessradio.net.
It's time for the news at noon for Monday, June 4th, 2018. This weekend in Guatemala, at least 25 people have been reportedly killed and 300 injured after a volcano erupted, spewing ash and lava over the surrounding area. The Guatemalan army said it evacuated 3,100 people from around the volcano, 70 kilometers southwest of Guatemala City. The volcano remains in an eruptive phase, and the country's disaster management agency said it fears the death toll could climb even higher because there were communities that could not be accessed by Sunday evening. Last week, two of the major Italian populist parties reached an unusual agreement to co-lead the country, instituting what it calls, quote, a government of change. Today, the anti-establishment Five-Star Movement, led by Luigi Di Maio, and the anti-immigrant Euroskeptic League, led by Matteo Salvini, says Italy will no longer be Europe's refugee camp, promising tough action to reduce migrant arrivals and send back those who have already come. Italy has become the main route into Europe for economic migrants and asylum seekers, with hundreds of thousands making the trek from North Africa each year and thousands dying at sea. Salvini, in a radio interview on Monday, said that Italy, quote, can't be transformed into a refugee camp, and vowed to lobby Italy's partners to obtain more EU assistance to handle the problem. The new government was sworn in on Friday of last week. This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court